you've tapped or clicked in to College Volleyball Weekly on Viral Volley Media. Now here's your host, Rob on mic.
All right, good day, everyone, and welcome to College Volleyball Weekly Men's Top 20. And this would be episode 17. We just concluded week 16 of play. And with that, we had every single conference tournament conclude, and we do have our NCAA playing field. But before we go into detail on that, got to introduce Brad Rothschild of UC San Diego, Dan Friend of Lewis, Jay Hossick of the Mighty Hossicks of George Mason, and Theo Edwards of San Fernando State University or Nordoff State or the Theoites University, whatever he's going by now. That would be CSUN. So good morning, gentlemen. Good to have you back on. And I'm sure we all watched a lot of volleyball in the last few weeks. And unfortunately, some people's journeys finished as well. So let's start off. You know, I forgot to say, we'll do the elephant in the room and we'll start off with Theo, since I've been dropping them last few episodes. So go for it, Theo.
Yeah, so we traveled to the island for the Big West Championships this week. And it was an awesome event. Had essentially everybody from the Big West gets an opportunity to make it. And I got to apologize ahead of time. Lost my voice over the weekend. So it was a good time. You know that was the case. But anyways, we ended up facing off with UC San Diego and Brad's team the first night, and it was a heck of a battle. So a lot of back and forth, and you know, our guys, I think it was a kind of a unique point in our season, in the sense that, you know, we kind of talked all year about trying to be the best version of ourselves in the final weeks of our season. And I think that's exactly what happened. You know, Brad and UC San Diego had beaten us twice in the regular season, and you know, was really, really playing some good ball, and we came out and put a lot of service pressure, you know, from the end line, and found a way to be really, really effective, and ended up beating them in three. And it was a really nice win for our program and kind of for our seniors signing off. And it was a good win. And then on night two, we faced off against the future Big West champs and Long Beach State, and had a heck of a battle with them. I think we had a lead in set one. It was 23-21, and had some incredibly unfortunate things bounce against us, and including a trickle net serve by Siaponis that was just absolutely unfortunate. But Long Beach is a fantastic team, and you know, obviously they've been great all year, and you know, that night was no different. They ended up beating us in four, and I thought that Jalen Phillips for us had a fantastic tournament. You know, as a freshman, his first time doing this, and he played absolutely tremendous. And we had some awesome seniors that we got to say goodbye to, both Kyle Hovis and Griffin Walters, who had incredible seasons for us and incredible careers for us. Han Oteo and TC Cook also had great careers, and got to say goodbye to those guys. But man, we had a great time and played some really, really high level volleyball.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to do some of that Brad go, being that you did face off against each other, and let the other coaches chime in on those matchups. So go for it, Brad.
Yeah, we got out to Hawaii and faced off with Theo for round three of our matchups, and they got the best of us. What, that was Thursday night? It feels like a week ago, but yeah, it's a few days ago. And yeah, Theo mentioned a little bit, but their service pressure, they got some aces early on us that really got us out of rhythm, got us out of sorts. And really, as we started finding little ways to get some momentum, get rhythm, and get playing, especially in set two, Northridge just kept responding and kept responding and kept responding, whether it be with a big dig or a big block touch or another tough serve. So it was just one of those matches where we were never really in a rhythm or never really clicking. And a lot of it was in part to Northridge service pressure. And offensively, they were lights out, especially Griff Walters and Jalen Phillips. went off when we were trying to slow down Hobus, and we were able to slow him down a little bit, but the other guys really, really stepped up. So yeah, it was a three set match, but one of the ones that feels like it was a lot longer. When you get out of it, you're like, that was a battle. That was a grind. And yeah, it was an unfortunate ending for us, and definitely a surreal feeling where it feels like there's more to come, and that we had bigger plans and more plans for what we were hoping to accomplish within the tournament and out in Hawaii. But ultimately, it was really, we were able to do some really special things throughout the year, and ultimately also this weekend, do some things that were a little unique to us that really kind of put a bow on the season and really kind of sent off our seniors and our guys on a less sour note.
Yeah. All right, Dan and Jay, as the outsiders, chime in on the paths of Theo and Brad.
Well, the first thing I want to comment on is how disappointed I am that it was played so late for us on the East Coast. I mean, I was up till 2 or 3 in the morning watching some of these matches, and I get it. I mean, it's in Hawaii. There's nothing we can do about it, but I was just bummed that I couldn't watch with a little bit more vim and vigor, if you will. I had my own things I had to worry about, but you know, it shows that in the Big West, there are some teams that, you know, we're just a little bit head and shoulders above everybody else. But that doesn't mean that the teams that did not make it past the first round or second round are not worthy of discussion. I thought Theo had done a fantastic job this year with his team. Kyle Hobus, obviously, you know, everybody knows the name, everybody knows the kid and what he can do. And he has been a stalwart. I think Griffin Walters maybe didn't get the fanfare, but the coaches knew about him and they knew he was doing. And if you weren't paying attention, then he definitely made you pay. I think you look at a kid like Jalen Phillips as a freshman, kid touches 12, 13 feet and was hitting balls with authority all year long. And yeah, there were some moments, you know, but listen, every team has got a freshman on the court at some point during the year, and they're going to make freshman mistakes. They're going to make freshman swings. I mean, look at Darcy at UC Irvine. He gets 7 foot, for Christ's sakes. And there's a lot of plays where you look at him going, I wish he wouldn't have made that swing choice. But are you kidding me? Like, these kids are in the biggest stage now, and they're still producing really good results. And Jalen's going to be a handful moving forward. And so I couldn't be more excited for them. And obviously, you know, losing is not what the end goal is, but there's no shame in any of those seasons. Everybody played really, really well all year long, and they were a lot of fun to watch.
Nice call, Jay. Dan.
Theo's got summer bragging rights. Sorry, Brad. So, both teams are great. Brad had some great wins, and Theo had some great wins, and somebody's got to win in the end. And, you know, I guess the solace for Brad was he was in Hawaii when he lost. So that's not a bad place to be if you're going to lose somewhere. Do you know what I mean? In terms of volleyball. So, I mean, the Big West tournament, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more, but like a lot of good volleyball being played, and what better venue to play it in terms of fans watching and all that stuff. So, you know, is Anthony Dunn, Brad? I couldn't remember. He's a stud too. So he's got a couple of great guys coming back for Brad as well as Theo does, doing me in terms of that. So,
yeah, Anthony Sherfine really turned it up a tail part of your season there, Brad. So,
yeah, I heard he might graduate. Brad heard he academically is just advanced. He's ready to get out.
Units wise, he probably could, but transferring into the UC system, you lose a couple units here or there.
Well, with that, I know, Dan, unfortunately, your team was out last week, but I know you're tracking a lot of stuff. But, you know, what things were catching your eyes? We'll kind of transition to our next segment with your take on the MEVA tournament. And
how can you not? I watched the Lindenwood match against Ball State. I mean, you know, Connor Sheehan was pretty impressive. There's a reason he's leading the country in assists per games. And, you know, that group was really playing well, and they were doing some great things, serving tough, putting a ton of pressure. Honestly, in game five, if they don't go miss five serve, I think that game's done faster. And I think the unfortunate side on Ball State's side is they really just had T to lean on, and Patrick Rogers tried to play a little bit in the first game and a half, and whether he wasn't conditioned or the ankle wasn't there, or I mean, that's tough. You haven't played for 3 or 4 weeks, and then you got to step in, and your first match is, let's go, go, go. That's not an easy thing to ask any guy. You know what I mean? And he's a young guy in terms of that. So I think Lindenwood capitalized, and ultimately, Ohio State's been playing some great volleyball here at the end, and you know they played Loyola, and you know again Loyola, you know they got the player of the year in Parker Van Buren, but he was the only guy carrying the weight at the time, and. I think between Wetzel and Pasture and Michael Wright really stepped it up. There's a reason he's the MVP of that tournament. You know what I mean? And so, like, even on us, he was just serving some extreme pressure, and he did a really nice job. And so seeing them go over Loyola and in the end, ultimately, Ohio State taking the win. You know, one of the unique things is our tournament went to a different format, and good or bad, it just, you know, you end up playing a 3-4 match at Ball State, and in terms of that, or even like Loyola might have hosted Ohio State at home, and I think there was one of those things that was a little different. Past 10 years, it'd be like those matches would have been at the higher seeds' home place and possibly sold out or in like large crowds. So, so it's a give and take. You know, a lot of you guys do the tournament format, but ours has been a little bit different. So it'll be interesting to see the feedback from the coaches at the end of that. But congrats to Ohio State. You know, in the end, they were just a little bit too much for Lindenwood, and their pieces were on fire and doing some great things, and it'll be a good representation for them either.
Yep. You know, got to go over to Jay and his Patriots, who were running through the EIVA tournament and then came up against the projected 1-2 matchup, Penn State, and the famous Star Wars matchup. We like to say the apprentice and master matchup. So, Jay, jump on in.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't be more proud of my guys and the way that they played this year. My seniors, just they were fantastic to work with. They really picked up a lot of slack in places where it needed to be done. But you know, we go in number two, and you know, we face against Charleston in the first round for us in the semifinals. They handily beat Princeton the night before. And those are two teams that we split with during the year, and Charleston beat us in 4 and we beat them in 5 and in extra points at their place. And they are a handful. Luke has a group of guys that know how to play the game at a high level. And, you know, we put together a pretty good game plan, and, you know, we were concerned about Delancey on the outside for obvious reasons. A kid touches like Jalen Phillips, like 15 feet, and he just throws it down, and we made a couple of adjustments. I thought we served really well, and we slowed Delancey down a great tremendous amount. And next thing you know, we're sweeping them in 3, and we're feeling pretty good about going into the finals. In Harvard, that night played Penn State, and we're up 24-19 in game 1, and could not finish it out and lost, I think, 28 or 27, 29 or whatever the case was. But that could have been a real big difference maker, because Harvard won the third game as well. And they could have been up 2-1 on Penn State and maybe have taken it out if they would have gone 5. But unfortunately they couldn't do it. So Penn State and us in the finals, we came in, I thought we had a good game plan. I thought we were going to play pretty well, and we had a lot of motivation. Won the first set, felt good about that, and went into the second, and they beat us in that by a few points. We went into the third, we're up late, feeling pretty good, and just, you know, we ran into a juggernaut of serving and defense. They served really well. I think they made, what, 12? I forgot what the ace to error ratio was, but I think it was 12 aces to 13 errors. That is ridiculous. And they dug a lot of balls. They dug us by, I think, 14 or 15 more balls than we got, and they were able to convert those. I mean, that was the difference maker in my eyes. But, you know, Penn State is a good team. We didn't lose to, you know, Podunk University. We lost to a program that is historically strong, and, you know, it's not the way we wanted to end it, but I liked a lot of the things that we did this year. And I felt that this group finally put us back on the map and as a team to, you know, talk about in the future. And, you know, hopefully we can build on it the next year.
Good call. Coaches want to chime in on the MIVA and or the EIVA matchups?
Yeah, I'll start with Jay's matchup. You know, I think in the beginning of the year, right, George Mason comes out to the West Coast, and and has some big wins, get some big upsets on some major teams, and I think turn some heads and has everybody going, hey, this George Mason team is pretty damn good. And then they backed it up all year long. And, you know, you give a lot of credit. Jay did a fantastic job with his group and those seniors and Omar Hoyos and Jack Bowles. I mean, those guys were really, really good all year. And, you know, obviously to lose in the finals is never anyone's plan. It's never anybody's mission. But I think George Mason did a fantastic job, and Penn State is obviously playing some really good ball, and obviously they were the better team that night, but that could have been anybody's match. That's the reality of it. And that's the way it always stings, you know, for coaches. You realize a couple of plays, a couple of things go differently, and maybe you get that one. But Jay, I thought you did a nice job. I thought George Mason had a heck of a year.
You know, Jay, I had to pull up that stat line. Penn State, 12 aces for their 13 errors. But reading in between the lines, that means they're throwing some serious service pressure, because although they didn't get the ace, you guys weren't in system a whole bunch.
Yeah. Our passers, which we have been known to be a pretty good passing team, we had no answer. And I don't know what it was. I wasn't on the court, but, you know, hats off to Penn State. It's more about them than it is about us. And, you know, they put some pressure on us that we hadn't seen. So it is what it is.
I thought Charleston with some late season kind of, you know, getting healthy and winning the first round of the EVA for the first time in program history. And so kudos to Luke and his group of guys, you know, finding a way to be resilient towards the end of the season.
You know, one of the guys that has been in the top stats for Charleston has been Garrett Schnitker. And he really got to step up in that match against Princeton. It was 17.5 points, but had a couple aces, great, you know, 5 digs, 3 block assists. But he's always been in the top leading the way, even through the injured phase of the Golden Eagles. So it's good to see. I mean, unfortunately, Sam was the one that suffered the loss from it and had a great team this year with Ben and Nero Omane. But in the end, Delancey stepped it up. It gave Schnitker enough room to move and actually get some point scoring done. So, you know, I'm sure that was I watched a little bit of that, and it was a really fun match to watch. So,
yeah. And the EIVA final with Penn State, George Mason. Really, I thought George Mason and Jay, they did a great job of slowing down Penn State. Their offense really was struggling. And, you know, the middles had some success, but for the most part, it was they did a really good job containing those 3 pin hitters for Penn State. And, you know, and Penn State passing such an effective rate comparatively to the service pressure that they were applying on George Mason, to see those offensive numbers so similar just speaks to how closely those teams were matched up. But I think something to watch is Penn State's passing really, really well. And if they can continue passing and serving well, that makes it really scary heading into what we're going to be getting into with the NCAA tournament.
I was talking in the press conference afterwards. If you would have told me that we would have kept Kerr at 215 or under, kept Valenzi at 147, I think is what he hit, and Kowal at like 213 or something like that, I would have said, I like our chances. But Toby Izionu was an absolute handful. We had no answer for him. I was happy we got a throw call on him, which I thought was kind of nice. And we finally got one of those. But, you know, for the most part, this was actually a match that people asked me about that. You know, are you concerned? And I said, it's like watching a train going towards your house at a slow pace. You know it's going to hit your house. You know it's coming. There's nothing you can do. You can only hope that it doesn't do a lot of damage. And thankfully it didn't. And it wasn't the reason why we lost. There were very, very few questionable calls. I thought the ref and Koo did a great job. And, you know, it is what it is. At this point, I'm just happy the way we played all year long, and we'll take that away.
Yep.
And then from my perspective, the MEVA final, you know, what really stood out was just A.J. Lewis was playing great offensively, but really and I hadn't watched him a ton throughout the year, but it seemed like his passing was really great in the quarterfinal and the semifinal. And Ohio State service pressure just really ended up kind of affecting that serve receive. And he was still great offensively, like he had been all year long. But that passing really made a difference, you know, and Pastor still is not quite in full rhythm, you know? So hopefully he's able to be, as good as he can be, for next week and for the matches ahead, because he is, quite the player. You know, you see it, he killed what 50% of the balls he got throughout the whole tournament. He aced at 10%. So just pretty ridiculous numbers there, for him.
Yeah. That passion, 18 kills at 394 in that final, or that MEVA final. But to pay, also need to pay attention to Shane Wetzel, who had a great tournament as well at 13 kills, hit 321. But you know, Pasture at 394, it's funny, like, oh, he could be playing better than that. I'm like, he's got the ability to take over a match. You know, after seeing him at the first point, I'm like, wow, Ohio State's gonna be a handful. And then of course that injury unfortunately got him, or his knee was slowed him down, and they're without him for a little bit. But I mean, that's a team that people got to keep their eye on in the NCAA tournament, but we'll talk about that a little more later. So one of the conferences that caught my attention, though, the SIAC tournament. You know, all year long, we've been talking about Fort Valley State and with the other Edward Waters being the likely finalists. But the result that caught me was it was the upset of their tournament there. Central State ended up beating Edward Waters. And I'm trying to get to my score here. It was a 3-1, I believe.
3-1.
So interesting, Tyrone Sands really stepped up those last two matches for Central State. But what else do we know about the SIAC tournament and what transpired there?
Well, I think something interesting there is with Central State, early on in the year when they came out to California, they were struggling. They had the injury bug going through them, and had a couple other issues that they were sorting through. So I think, you know, I think similar to like what we talked about with Charleston, is they were able to put some stuff together throughout the year, and that adversity can make you or break you. And, you know, and if it, you end up making yourself through that adversity and having to play some guys in different spots, and guys get healthy, guys come back, and it leads to the opportunity to take on or take down what, you know, at least us from the outside might perceive as an upset in those situations. So I think it was more just as the year goes on, a team's going to keep evolving.
Yep.
And I think Fort Valley State was the team to beat all year long. Che Cooper and Isaiah Fed on the outsides that have done a fantastic job with them. Larry is really building that program to be, you know, a powerhouse in that conference for years to come. And I think Theo might touch upon it later. There's an argument to go to 16 teams. And one of the reasons is, you know, Fort Valley State has taken a spot, rightfully so. They earned it with the AQ. But there's five or six or seven other teams that, you know, what if Fort Valley State plays against a lower seed team that got in, maybe isn't at large, that was on the bubble? You never know what they could do at that point. And I think nobody thinks that Fort Valley State is the favorite going up against UCLA. And I don't think they're going into it thinking they're absolutely going to win this match, but they're building for the future. And they're doing a nice job out there. That program is going to be someone that you are going to definitely take notice of in the next few years.
Yeah.
Well, kudos to Dr. Anita Brockman. And she's the one that runs Central State, and you know, she played a tough schedule in the beginning, and to see those guys, you know, that's what you want to do, peak at the right time. And, you know, Brad kind of said it, you know, they showed some resiliency, and that's a great win for them getting into the final. And and compliment to Larry and his group. We kind of knew that they were kind of running the show, and so not surprised to see those guys come out on top at the end. And I know they're going to represent well. And the overall conference and first point getting that conference off the ground and all the work that's been going on the past couple of years. And I think that's all great growth for the game. And, you know, people at the naked, you know, not really knowing what's going on, like the naked eye may see it and go, why are they in the tournament? But everybody that knows about men's volleyball knows it's a good thing, and we're headed in the right direction. And I certainly won't disagree with Jay on 16, 12, any more teams, any way we can do it. They may go to 9 next year and not go to 12 yet. Like, how are you going to do that, Brack? That's a whole different our discussion about how the NCAA can't just figure this out and, like, expand the bracket sure that's done for next year, but I'm not going to rant on that yet. So.
That could open up a hornet's nest of a topic there.
Well, yeah, but get them to move the championships. Anyway, I'm just going to be quiet right now. So.
No, but I think it's a great call, and the SIAC was an awesome finish, and you know Fort Valley obviously has been the favorite. Larry Rather's doing a great job, but you know Tyrone Sands in Central State, when they were out here in California, so when we played them, we beat them in three, but of the 58 attempts that they had attacking wise, Tyrone Sands had 50% of them. And I remember as a coaching staff, we were saying, this guy's pretty darn good. And he's got a huge ceiling ahead of him. And it was just awesome to see what the coach has done there. And Anita, I mean, she has such an incredible story, hearing her talk about her road into volleyball and her son playing the game at a young age and her being a professor and all of the really, really cool things that she's brought to her team, but also having the foresight to say, hey, let's take you out west and get some really big time experience to prepare you for these moments. And Tyrone played incredibly well. And, you know, that was a really nice upset for them. And even against Fort Valley, you know, he still had 17 kills and 10 digs, 19 total points, and really just had a great match. So awesome SIAC battles.
Yeah. Anything else on SIAC, gentlemen? Nope. Well, I just want to add that Isaiah Fed led in that championship match, the first ever SIAC automatic berth, first tournament for them. 13 kills for Isaiah Fed, ace, and 14 and a half points. And Jay's former boy, Shea Cooper, 10 kills, 368, three aces, and 13 digs, chipping in 13 and a half points.
Attaboy, Jay. Way to represent, kid. Nice job.
With that, we're going to go to the Conference Carolinas, and I have to admit, it's kind of pulling for an upset for King, and they did it in that first round against Erskine. But I want to get your overall summary of the Conference Carolinas tournament. Let's start with you, Dan.
Yeah, I was stoked for King. Like when we sent a little message, like seeing those guys getting upset, and I was wondering if they were going to do it again. Do you know what I mean? But Belmont Abbey, like they've been really good all year. You know, 20-win season, and Derek's doing a great job, and I think they're going to be a good representation of that conference and all the work that's been put in there over the years. And so, kudos to those guys, and what a great finish at the end there. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I thought Belmont Abbey showed they could win in lots of different ways. They had their outside hitter Puentes go off in the semifinal. Then in the final, Stauskenis, sorry, Matt, if I butcher that for you. But and then he goes off in the final. And I think the big thing that stood out in the final, we talked about the ace to air ratio. It was for Belmont Abbey in that four set final, they had six aces and nine airs, something like that. And served in at 90% plus, which is pretty ridiculous to do. So just kind of a dominating performance from them from the end line. And cool to see it done with different guys stepping up and different guys filling into different roles as the tournament evolved.
Anything else on Conference Carolinas?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Belmont Abbey moving on. These guys hit it on the head in terms of the finals. But I got to shout out Warren Davis. And, you know, we've talked about him kind of briefly all year. And, Rob, you've mentioned him quite a bit. But his 23 kills hitting 524 in the upset over Erskine, that is impressive. That is really, really impressive. And, you know, I was rooting for them silently, hoping that they would make another run. But, man, Warren Davis did a great job.
It was Ryan Boer's, like, whiskey last year they brought into the hotel room that made me a fan of King. He's making his case out of the backwoods. He's like, you gotta try this, Rob. I'm like, what? Oh, it's now Thursday. But yeah, this is the thing. If you're watching or listening, Warren Davis is listed at 6'1". That's a very liberal 6'1".
Very generous.
Platform shoes on that kid with that height.
He's playing in Prince's boots, I'm pretty sure.
Well, and that's it. People that don't know, when you're a shorter player, don't think about, you got to expend 100% energy all the time to keep up with some of the guys like Hobus and those 6'8", 6'9", 6'10" outside hitters. just to keep up with him. And I mean, that's not easy. And so kudos to that kid, man. It's been awesome to see him play.
Well, we cannot forget about the MPSF, and I'll let you guys run with it. But what were some of the eye-catching results and play of the MPSF? We'll go back to Dan, since we're coming up on saying goodbye to Dan here, I think. So I want to definitely get his thoughts.
Well, you know, I think ultimately SC hosting and, you know, kind of, you know, upsetting that first round against BYU. I mean, I kind of thought that might happen. SC's good, you know what I mean? And certainly playing in the confines of their own home. And so, but then the kind of jump forward, I mean, not shocked with UCLA and GCU. I'm not shocked it went five games and just, you know, lots of great volleyball. And I caught the tail end of the match, but man, GCU just consistent towards the end in terms of what they were trying to do and the pressure they were bringing, and you know just some key pieces, and Nick Slight and Hickman, and you know, just, you know, really impressive. And it's gonna be a couple fun rounds in the tournament next weekend for sure.
Well, I wanted to just add that that quarterfinal matchup between USC and BYU. Jack Duker, 30 kills, 407, 4 aces, 7 digs, and a block assist to just get 32 and a half points. That's all. No big deal.
And a partridge and a pear tree.
And so, you forgot Caleb's 61 assist. You know what I mean?
That's right. Like,
yeah. So,
coaches, thoughts on the MPSF tourney?
If you look at my bracket, I'm about 80% success rate, but I missed the BYU-USC match. I called BYU to win that one. I did call the Lindenwood over Ball State, though, and that one I was pretty proud on. But I think the two right teams were in the final. Grand Canyon, it's tough to go in knowing that this other team is, you know, had your number the last couple of matches, but they were close. At least one of them was. And, you know, what Matt Worley's doing out there with his staff is nothing short of remarkable. They made that program into an absolute powerhouse. And it's going to be really fun to see them come into this tournament now with some experience, because they were there last year and it's not going to be anything new to them. So now they're going to be in a whole nother position. So kudos to Worley and his crew. It was a lot of fun to watch, and first championship, MPSF championship for them in program history. So super stoked.
Other coaches, Brad or Theo?
Yeah. I mean, if my memory serves me correctly, I remember at this point last year, it seemed like Grand Canyon was having a little bit of a lull. Right. They maybe weren't playing their best, kind of misfiring on a few things. And they kind of went into the tournament not quite 100%. And I feel like that lull happened for them right around the outrigger, where they had a couple of strange matches, a couple of losses. They made a few roster adjustments, kind of went through some tweaks, and have kicked it into gear. And obviously are now playing some really, really great volleyball. And, you know, I think similar to Brad and I's match, you know, GCU loses to UCLA in the regular season, and it is incredibly difficult to beat a team three times, and especially three straight. And so obviously they're primed, and I think it's going to be really, really interesting in this tournament to see how it goes. It's always better to be walking in there with some confidence than it is to have a couple of things going wrong. So shout out to Worley and Grand Canyon, man. They're looking like the favorites right now.
Yeah, I thought it was relatively chalk. Obviously, you had the BYU-USC upset. You know, and I think if you're BYU and they're saying, hey, you're going to keep Dylan Klein to 12 kills, you feel like you're going to be taking care of business and getting out with a three-set sweep. But Jack Duker and 30 kills is a hell of a performance. And Luke Benson's their left side blocker there, and he's a pretty darn big kid. So it wasn't like he was doing it against a small blocker, a big mismatch there. So that was a huge performance and a huge, interesting twist with them rotating their host site around and USC hosting, obviously playing a advantage for that upset. You know, and then I thought everything else was chalk, right? For the most part, you have Stanford over Pepperdine. I thought that game was pretty controlled by Stanford, which was impressive to see, because I thought those were two more evenly matched teams from there. So those guys played great. And then just Will Rotman had a hell of a career at Stanford, and obviously his season's done, but I think him and the rest of that senior class at Stanford did an amazing job dealing with what everything Stanford has done and been through over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. or so. And then, yeah, Grand Canyon versus UCLA in the final. I think we all saw it coming and we all were excited to watch it and check it out. And I just loved Grand Canyon's resiliency. You know, you see set one, the Bic really, Cooper Robinson gets two kills on the Bic and goes over by millimeters and swings a lot of the momentum to Grand Canyon's way. And then it's just a prize fight going back and forth and back and forth. And just a couple hitting errors by UCLA in that fifth set gives Grand Canyon just enough of an edge to pull it away. And I thought Nick Slight, again, another great performance. And I thought, especially in transition medium system, he really upgraded his setting, keeping tempo to the pins and even finding ways to get the middles going. And then Cameron Thorne and Rico Wardlow matching up on Merrick McHenry and slowing him down and controlling him a little bit more than he had seen all year long in that matchup in the final. So, yeah, I think it's credit to Matt Worley and the entire staff out there. And for UCLA, there's a little bit of good to come out of that too, because now, you know, you didn't get affected in terms of your seeding and you're still the top seed. And now you got a little bit of a chip on your shoulder heading into the national tournament.
Yeah. You know, it was close. And I was driving during that match, so I couldn't, well, yes, I had it on in the car, but did that go to video challenge a Cooper Robinson attack line fault, the 10 foot line? I couldn't tell. I wasn't watching closely.
I was just watching on volumetrics, so I didn't see.
Oh, gotcha. I just assumed that. I think it was late in the match, and I'm like, I'm sure someone had a challenge. So with that, I know, Dan, you've got to go, but I've got to get one more conference in there. NEC, their non-auto berth conference, but kind of a shocker there. We've been following St. Francis, Nathan Zini, the NEC Player of the Year. But Damon ends up with the upset over number one, St. Francis. Thoughts, gentlemen?
Called it.
I don't know if it's an upset. Sorry, Brad. I mean, St. Francis, it isn't seeding, but Damon's good. Like, I mean, so I knew it was going to be a battle with those two. And you know, granted, St. Francis is the number one, but I just thought it was one of those other great matches within a conference that should have a bid into the tournament. But that's a different conversation, too, I mean. So otherwise, we'd be seeing Damon on a nine team. Do you know what I mean? And so, compliment to you know the Damon group, and you know, kind of stepping up, and you know, Schneider, you know, having 16 kills, but you know, just a great win by them, and probably a tough environment. So.
Yeah, that Damon group is good. You got Schneider, Milligan has had some really big time performances. And I think another thing is Sacred Heart in the opening round upsets the three seed Long Island in the 6-3 upset. I thought that was an impressive performance for Sacred Heart. And, you know, I thought they started playing a little bit better as the year went on. And obviously a great performance there to end up coming up with what was that upset in a team in Long Island where we talked about a little bit more as opposed to Sacred Heart. So shout out to Sacred Heart and their coaching staff and their players.
Yep.
Not an upset, Damon winning over St. Francis. All the coaches here know Don Gleason's done a nice job of that program. They deserve that win. Secondly, Sacred Heart's going to be a team you're going to want to look at in the future because they're going to be fully funded with 4.5 scholarships for the first time in program history, hopefully in the next couple of years. And they're redoing their entire gym and rebuilding it. So that program is going to be really good moving forward. And last but not least, dear NCAA, please go to 16 teams. Please stop slow playing us.
Please. Dan smirking in the back there. He knows something.
I don't know anything. Like, so I just agree with Jay. Hey guys, I got to go. If we're doing our picks.
All right.
I just, it's tough because I think your 6-3 is a tough match. I think your 4-5 is a tough match. I mean, those are going to be fantastic first round games. But UCLA and Long Beach in the final.
Ooh.
I don't know that I'm comfortable with that, but I'm just going to call that. Do you know what I mean? In terms of the other day. Oh, wait, Long Beach is hosting at home. They're so good at home. Anyway, great seeing you guys. Pearl, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
You did.
Dan, friend of Lewis. Taking his jet somewhere. All right. So we still have a lot to talk about and we're 45 minutes in. So good discussion there, gentlemen. And I mean, hopefully, you know, let me go in with now who's in the tournament.
Or hold on, I got one more thing to add to that same Damon conversation. And again, I think we've seen it multiple times, and I mentioned this before with us and UC San Diego, but to beat a team three times is really tough. St. Francis beat Damon twice in the regular season. And so now you're coming up on the third matchup, and coaches know that is a tough thing to do. And Damon coming out on top is no surprise. That team was 20-6 this year. They're a good team. Donnie Gleason is doing a fantastic job with that group. And Zach Schneider is a good volleyball player, man. He's really, really good. So super stoked for them. I thought that was a great win for Damon.
There's a great meme that Damon put out. I don't know if you guys saw it, but back in the old SNL days when it was funny, there was Patrick Swayze and Chris Farley dressed up as Chippendales dancers. And if you don't know what a Chippendales dancers is, Google it, because this is a family-friendly show. But it shows their bodies, just their top half showing. You know, Patrick Swayze's perfect body, and then Chris Farley's plus-size body. It says NCAA committee bid process, and then underneath it says we get it, and it has Damon on Chris Farley and D12 schools on Patrick Swayze. So I love the humor there, so I have to give a shout out to that. With that, let's go with our eight teams that are in. One seed UCLA.
Rob, you skipped the Big West Conference Tournament.
Oh yeah, huh? Well, yeah, Big West Tournament, Long Beach won, and what'd you say?
Isn't that supposed to be the elephant in the room for you, Rob?
I feel like that should have came out in the elephant in the room, Rob.
Okay, well, that hurt, kind of. But this is the thing. One thing that I knew towards the end of the season that we hadn't seen the best of Long Beach State because Clark Godbold had been not 100%, and everyone knows he's a good player. And he'll change that lineup. I mean, they already have a tough lineup to deal with. Sotir Shipanis, Simon Torwey, and Skylar Vargas really been picking up as of late. And Aiden Knipp has really picked up his blocking game too, which has helped that defense, as well as his ability to run the offense with what he's got, become successful. But Clark Godbold became Clark Kent's other identity against UC Irvine. He felt like he could... otherwise known as Superman for you non-comic book readers, he turned it on. And that was the Clark Godbold that we were seeing last year when he was 100%, being able to deliver, but he was an opposite. He had him going to left side this year, and he just was unstoppable. Everything he was doing was working. And I love getting the unsung heroes, because Mason Briggs in serve receive was phenomenal. UC Irvine was serving tough. It's just that they're getting it in the area of Mason Briggs, and he's able to get a good first ball, and you know, Aiden is able to run the offense pretty well. But Long Beach State ended up winning 3-1, and it was definitely a slugfest. It was slow, but you know, there's some big hits. They were able to slow Halir Hanno down, and that was a big deal. I mean, he only got 16 kills, but he'd got 20 plus, was hitting over 450 in previous matches, and they found a way to slow him down. I think on defense, they just were able to dig a lot more of his balls and get more contacts off the block so they could run something in transition. So, you know, great job by Alan Knipe and his coaching staff to get his team dialed into that final match. But Long Beach State is definitely, they flex their muscles, and there's going to be another new number one this week, or a renew number one this week in the ABCA poll because of that win, because what I saw in those last two sets from Long Beach State on Saturday night or Sunday morning for us on the Pacific Coast, and that was just them flexing their muscles. Yeah, you know, they may have shown too many cards, though, because now everyone's going to be preparing for this ultra mega powerful Long Beach State team that showed up on Saturday night in Hawaii. So with that, anything to add on? You want to chime in on the Big West final?
Just one thing in relations to the seeding when we talk about the tournament. I'm so surprised that Long Beach didn't get the one seed. I think they deserved it.
It makes zero sense.
Yeah.
Well, there's one theory I've got, which I'll bring up in the next segment. But, Brad, anything to add, though, on the Big West?
No, I would just say, one, the semifinal matchup, and I'm bitter – So I didn't watch the Northridge Long Beach one. But the other semifinal matchup was the, I was thinking about different ones, but one of the most impressive individual performances I had ever seen with Jahlil Hinault. He had 45 something swings, 25 kills or so. He had one hitting error, and it was on an out of system pipe when they were kind of in control of the match in the third set, like up 15 to 10. He had another hitting error where Hawaii ended up netting. He hits it out by trying to go really sharp 4-4 and hits it out, but Hawaii ended up netting. And it was just so impressive watching that performance and how they were attacking and utilizing Hinault. It was just really masterful by him. You know, I think it, yeah, they didn't end up winning the tournament, but I think that performance alone is going to keep them in any match and keep them close with everyone. It was fantastic.
His ability to find the one square foot on the court on the other side where the one player can't make the dig is uncanny. I watched that match as well, and I'm seeing him do these little chips and rolls and tips and all this and that, and it just seems to find that one tile, that one square foot where somebody just can't reach it. And I'm just going, what? How is this guy able to have that kind of control? And listen, to me, that solidified his player of the year watching that match. The only other person right now that I would have had in that contention as a solid front runner would have been Clark Godbold if he had played more matches. But if he plays like he did on the championship night, that's a really, really top group of guys that you're looking at. Clark's going to be the difference maker for Long Beach in this tournament because he came back with a vengeance.
And something interesting with Long Beach, those two matches they played in Hawaii in the Big West Conference Tournament were two of their worst passing performances in serve receive. They had been consistently an elite passing team, and they were an average passing team.
Well, even when they're passing well, Brad, they're still running high balls. I mean, that's just the way that they run it. Granted, I know it's not exactly, but you should see some of these balls that Aiden is slinging around. It's up to the rafters, some of these things. The thing you have to keep in mind if you're an average fan is, do you know how hard it is to hit one of those things? That thing is up 30, 40 feet at sometimes. The amount of time that thing gets to get up there and then the speed that it starts to pick up, and you got to judge getting your hand on that thing, that is next level type attacking, and Long Beach is good at it. So it's going to be, you don't need to be in system when you got that kind of swing.
Yeah. Theo, did you have something to add there? I thought you were going to chime in on there.
Yeah, no, I'm actually putting together some notes for our next segment.
Gotcha.
Here's what I will say. I had an opportunity to watch that final match, and you know, Rob, we had talked earlier in the year, and I told you that, you know, in confidence, I thought Irvine was the favorite. And a lot of that really relied on Flexton, being able to pass, being able to stay in the lineup and be effective. And literally, we lose to Long Beach. And, you know, watching Flexton, even in the night against Hawaii, the very first 7 points,
yep.
Right? Flexton gets aced four times, ends up getting pulled. Tangator goes in. They turn it around, and kudos to Tangator. I mean, I thought he did a great job, but they turn it around and win. And in my head, I was thinking that might be the worst possible scenario for Irvine going into that next round, where Flexton has no confidence and Tangator, as great of a volleyball player as he is, he's not Flexton. And in order to beat Long Beach, it was going to take an offensive powerhouse that Irvine becomes when you have Flexton and Hinault in the lineup together and really firing on all cylinders. And I really give Niff a lot of credit because he was trying to figure out, how do we make this fit, get Flexton in on the right, figure out how to get more attacks and more offensive weapons out of him. But I think going into the tournament, if he can get a few passing reps and get his confidence back and be in a position to continue to bring balance to that group, that team is capable of beating anybody in the country. And it takes them being at full strength and obviously finding that rhythm.
Yeah. Well, with that, let's go into the NCAA selection. Show was obviously yesterday. We're recording on a Monday morning. Sunday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. Going to come out with the seeds with UCLA at number one, Long Beach State at two, Grand Canyon three, UC Irvine four, Penn State five, Ohio State six, Belmont Abbey seven, and Fort Valley State at eight. Question for you, gentlemen. Did the NCAA committee get it right? And yeah, Jay hasn't gone first this entire segment, so let's let him go.
First of all, why can't we get a link for the thing that works on the first try? Why does it have to be an error sign? NCAA, do better. Do better by us. We deserve that. No, they did not get it right. They got it right 75% of the way. I think Grand Canyon at three, with the top two teams ahead of them, I think it's probably the right move. UCI at four, I think that's fair. I think Penn State at five over Ohio State at six, I think that's fair. And Belmont Abbey and Fort Valley State at seven, I think that's fair. Where they got it wrong, UCLA and Long Beach. Long Beach deserves the number one seed. They have, you look at the criteria, and you look at the head-to-head, and you look at against teams in consideration. Ohio, UCLA has, what, five or six losses? Five losses? Long Beach has two? Yeah. You know, and then you look at the win-loss record on the road and against teams in consideration. I don't know how that happens, but that's the way they did it. And I think not only is it a slap in the face of Long Beach, it's a little bit of a slap in the face of Grand Canyon. But if you look at the head-to-head over the year, that's why they got that over Grand Canyon. So I think the three seed for them is fair, but I would have liked to have seen Long Beach at number one. I think they deserved it. And UCLA at number two. I think it doesn't really matter. It doesn't change much in the outcome of things. I still have those two potentially facing each other in the finals, but that's the only place I think where they got it wrong.
I don't know if I should insert my conspiracy theory there or let Brad and Theo go. But
so you
know,
I think Long Beach should have been number one if we're looking at it. If I'm going
clarification though. UCLA ended up the season with 23-5, while Long Beach is 25-2. So just wanted to get that out there before Brad went into his.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we all can see Long Beach probably being number one. And I think the ABCA poll is also going to show kind of the consensus of who everyone thinks number one is, you know, and I think maybe they relied a little bit too much on the KPI and some of those metrics within it, or maybe they went more on the eye test and what they've seen from them. I don't know exactly. I also think I could see Ohio State being the five instead of Penn State, but then Penn State beat Ohio State twice. So there's really no argument there. And then when we look at two and three and four, you got the piece that I really like about it is that when we get down to the top four teams, you know, we could potentially be seeing a rematch of a Big West versus MPSF school, which I don't know if that was the purpose of it or why they switched it, because you really don't have any other arguments for two and three or three and four being flipped. There'd be no way to put UC Irvine ahead of Grand Canyon. So I don't know if it was more about looking to get the conference separation and avoid having an all MPSF semifinal on one side or all Big West semifinal on the other side. Which takes a lot of foresight and a lot of predicting from the NCAA tournament committee. But I think for the most part, it's right. You know, I think Long Beach has every right to be upset that they're not the one seed. But I think really their draw is still pretty good. And I don't know how big of a difference the draw is going to be from the one and the two seed there. I guess you can argue you'd rather be playing UC Irvine than Grand Canyon. And especially now, that'll be the fourth time that Irvine and Long Beach would match up, and the fourth time that UCLA and Grand Canyon would match up.
This just in, I got on the ticker that Flexion's playing middle blocker in the tournament coming up. Just throw that out there.
Theo.
Yeah, the only thing that I could see why they set it up the way they did was just to balance out where the MPSF versus the Big West schools would be. That's the only thing that would make sense to me. Because you look at Long Beach against top 20 teams, their record is 16-2. You look at UCLA against top 20 teams, their record is 19-5. So I don't know. It seemed to me like Long Beach was the no-brainer one seed. But, man, I must not have been doing this long enough. Something didn't make sense. I'm assuming it has to do with the KPI piece of it. But yeah, I think otherwise they did get it right. I think the interesting piece is if UCLA wins the MPSF, then what would have happened? And where is Grand Canyon in this mix? The assumption would be they still get an at-large, but who knows?
I think it stays the exact same. I think the outcome of that match doesn't make any difference in terms of where they seed teams.
Think so?
I think so. That's my take.
So, Brad, you're actually going on to my conspiracy theory. I'm thinking the committee was saying they can't have teams from the same conference going at each other in the semifinal. And it made more sense for them to pop UCLA in the number one because at least their records were close. Whereas if you look at flipping GCU and UC Irvine, UC Irvine had 10 losses.
There's no way you can flip those ones.
So it's like, let's take the lesser of two evils, which is, hey, let's just throw UCLA number one because at least their records were closer, you know? So, but that's just, that's what a little birdie was saying to me as I was driving around this weekend. So
it makes sense. I get that argument. I can agree with it. Go to 16 teams.
There we go.
Are we ready for that conversation? Because I'm ready.
Yeah, let's go.
So, fired up. So Jay says 75% of the bracket was right. And then Brad's pretty much on board. Theo, kind of in between still?
No, I think they got it right if you leave it at 8, which is ridiculous. I mean, it's...
Okay, we're going to that discussion. Bracket expansion.
I think it's time to go to that discussion. And, I posted it on social media yesterday. And here's the thing for me. So I went ahead and pooled together all of the teams that are in the tournament currently, aside from Belmont Abbey and Fort Valley, because they just don't have enough competition against top 20 teams. But collectively, amongst the other six teams, they have 33 losses to the top 20. 33 losses to the top 20.
Wow.
If you're looking at how to make a conference or a NCAA championship great and how to make it exciting. This might be the best sport in the history of the NCAA to have a national tournament where you have the most competitive teams all in one tournament. And now granted, men's basketball has been this way for a long time, right? They have great funding. They have TV deals. They've got all of that. Now, if you look at men's basketball, what makes them great is the Cinderella stories that we have seen for decades, right? Yep. 33 losses to top 20 teams out of the six top teams in the bracket. The Cinderella stories are inevitable. The ability to put these universities, these programs on a stage and give them an opportunity to compete in front of millions of people, this is what the NCAA should be striving to do. This is why we exist. This is why this entity is in existence, is to give these amateur athletes an opportunity to showcase their skills and do it on a national level. And to me, cost-wise, this is not a big deal. This is an easy thing to achieve, but our sport is built for it. And more than ever, the game has grown to a place where it makes more sense than it ever has. And yeah, that's my soapbox spiel. And we need to get to 16 teams, and we need somebody to step up and say, hey, enough is enough. It's time to support men's volleyball.
I agree 1,000% with you, Theo. I've been banging this drum forever to anybody who'll listen. Here's another argument for it. When you see the top four teams in the Final Four, nobody should have a quote-unquote easy one-match path to get there. And right now, two teams, theoretically, and no slam against you, Belmont Abbey or Fort Valley State, but you've got a monumental task ahead of you, and two teams have a relatively easy path to get into that Final Four. If you go to 16, you take those bottom eight and fly them out or do it regionally, however you want to do it, the NCAA is going to expand our tournament 1 week further back. That weekend now that you have in between is perfectly placed to have all of those first, second round matchups to create a final eight teams, if you will, or final four teams, sorry. And that Final Four is going to be the gnarliest Final Four of all time because none of those teams are going to have easy matches getting in. And Cinderella teams, I love the thought of, you know, a Belmont Abbey or Fort Valley State being a Cinderella team. Those aren't the Cinderella teams of our sport. The Cinderella teams are the Stanfords, the Loyolas, the Hawaiis, the George Masons, the Lindenwoods, the Northridges. Those teams are the true Cinderellas because they're the teams that have beaten some teams up there and have shown that they can do it if they get hot at the right moment. And then you never know what can happen. They can knock out somebody quickly, and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, that's a whole nother story. This is why we need 16. This is why. If we can do it for D3, for Christ's sakes, we can do it for D1.
Whoa, reach it. Anything to add, Brad?
Not much. No, I mean, I would say, like, we got to get to 12 before we get to 16. Like, what you guys are saying is accurate.
No, don't.
Oh, that's just not how it works, though. That's not how the NCAA is going to be. We can't just
throw it
out and make it a thing. For 12. It has to progress.
We don't ask for 12. Go right to 16. Somebody get inside there and
fight. Nobody asked for 12.
I think going to 12, there's no difference. Going correct. To 12 versus going to 16, it's the same thing.
Correct.
It's a correct. Funky bracket. You have to add the extra week for playing. It doesn't matter. You might as well go correct. To 16.
Correct. And I understand, think cool,
but I just don't see –
I understand
the feasibility from the process of what we need to create as coaches.
Men's volleyball has a history of being happy-go-lucky and happy that we have something. We need to start taking the cues from the women's volleyball realm and saying, we're not standing for this. We deserve this, and here's the reason why, and it's better for our sport. And stop asking for inches when we should be asking for yards. I'm tired of going up one team at a time for 4 years. It's ridiculous. The NCAA is going down into hell in a handbasket right now. You think they're going to care about us in 3 years when they're probably not even going to exist anymore? We need to get this in now. We need somebody with a voice who can get in there and start banging some doors and saying, this is what we need now before you are completely non-existent. That's what I think.
Woo. It's getting hot in here. We need to take a break next week. We'll see. Well, I know we have gone long, but it was to be expected. And do you guys have a few more moments or should we just, well, I wanted to see if you are a person watching the NCAA championships next week, who are some of the players we should be looking for on each of the teams? I know we've dropped some stat lines here, but there are definitely some other names that haven't been mentioned because there was so much action, but who are some of the top names to be looking out for? We'll go with Theo.
Yeah. I think I'll take the middle blocker position and I'll throw a couple of really great middles out there. Toby Izanoe is unbelievable for Penn State. He's at a point in his career where I think consistency is very easy for him. And I think he has historically performed really well on this stage, and I think he's going to be fantastic. So definitely someone to watch out for. The other one would be Merrick McKendry at UCLA. I think those are two of the top middles in all of NCAA men's volleyball, and two guys that tend to never disappoint when you watch them play the game.
Yeah. All right, Brad.
Yeah, I'll just kind of list off a few that jump off with each team. I think UCLA, you got Merrick McKendry, like Theo mentioned, and then Ethan Champlin. And then you got Andrew Rowan, their setter, as well. Fort Valley State, Isaiah Fed, who we've talked about. And then also Jackson Hicks, who actually was the player of the year for the conference, is someone to keep an eye out for. UC Irvine, Hilaire Heno, we've talked about a ton. Another really, really entertaining one to watch there is Brett Sheward. He's looking to be the only, libero and setter to win a national championship, starting in both positions. I don't know if anyone's ever done that before.
Two different programs.
And then Penn State, John Kerr, Toby Izionu is a stud, but John Kerr on the right side is pretty darn impressive. Ohio State, I think what's Cole's last name? Cole Wright? The middle?
Oh, I just had on the tip of my – Cole Young.
Sorry, Cole. He's a freak. He's a stud. 6'10", long arms, jumps well. He's really good in the middle. And then you got Jacob Pastore as well. Grand Canyon, Nick Slide is one of the most entertaining setters you're going to watch. So he's definitely someone you want to be checking out and watching play. And then you got Camden Gianni. And then another interesting one is Jared Anderson, D3 player of the year, that is a grad transfer to Grand Canyon and been playing on the right side now for them the last month and a half of the season. Then at Long Beach State, you have Mason Briggs at libero, Simon Torwey in the middle, and then so does Sopanis, are three entertaining players. And then, where'd it go?
Brad, do you want to mention the concession stand workers? You want to mention the parking lot attendants?
No, but actually everything.
AJ, are you interested in going? No one's
here
left.
Here's one additional thought I have.
For Christ's sake, an additional thought?
Think of the people working the scoreboard. Think of the people working the stats. They're starting their day at 11 a.m. They got to be there early. The last match is at 7:30 p.m. They're going to be going 12 plus hour day. They're going to be seeing so much volleyball.
Why don't you start talking about Caitlin Clark, and you want to start talking about Tiger Woods and just, throw it around the room, man. Just, all right. So I'm going to go a different direction because now it's my turn. Dang it. First of all, I got to give a shout out to 2,334 people. And those people are the Hawaii fans that showed up for the finals, even though their team wasn't in it. Kudos to you, Hawaii. We know how much your fan base appreciates good volleyball. And to those people that showed up to watch that match and just enjoyed watching good volleyball, kudos to you guys. I got to give you guys a lot of love. All right. I'm going to go the way of Theo, and I'm going to pick a position. And I'm going to go at it from this perspective. You remember when you were a kid and you played Street Fighter, and every fighter that you had a different skill set, and everything was different, so you had to kind of figure out how to beat this one player who was really good with his hands, and then there was another player who was really good with his feet, and then there was another player who had fireballs, and all that kind of stuff, right? Setters. This is the group for me that I'm going to be watching. You have so many distinct different styles going into this tournament. They are absolutely fun to watch. You got Shuey at UC Irvine, a converted libero who set a little bit here and there, who doesn't necessarily run a flashy offense. He just puts the ball in the right spots, and he plays fantastic defense for obvious reasons. Nick Slight at Grand Canyon, one of my favorite setters in the country, cool, calm, collected, knows how to run an offense. Rowan, obviously, at UCLA, won it last year as a freshman. Now he's got a year of experience, runs a really good offense. You look at the young kid, Schwab, at Penn State. He's a true freshman coming in. He's slinging a rock to some of these guys. he's not exactly the cleanest setter. Like, he doesn't run this really exquisite type of offense. He just puts balls up there, but he's done a nice job and he's gaining lots of experience. You got Michael Wright at Ohio State who does good stuff. I mean, this is, and then you got Knipe, who's the gunslinger. The guy loves to chuck high balls up in the air. I don't think, you know, luckily they're playing at Long Beach because the pyramid is 1,000 feet in the air. Otherwise, the kid would go above that if he didn't hit the roof. So I'm really excited to watch those guys and in this tournament, because I think they're going to be the people for me that bring the most excitement and the most wide variety of styles in the tournament.
Yeah. Excellent calls. With that, I believe we should probably wrap it up here. We are way over our recording limit.
Hold on, Rob. I got to add one more thing. Sorry. All right. So in our match against Long Beach, the Hawaii fans started trickling in. And by the time that match had ended, the bowl was completely full. And in that period of time, they were chanting CSUN. And it was a moment for my guys that they will never forget. You're never in Hawaii with the crowd cheering for someone other than Hawaii. And I got to give a shout out to those fans, because I think that they are some of the best in volleyball and just an awesome experience for our young men. So really, really appreciative of those fans.
And that was after Brad threw you under the bus about your bracket, not having Hawaii.
Yeah, I was going to say, Brad, it didn't work. You're with us.
At all. Well, that is a conversation all in itself about Hawaii and their fans, but also the situation they're in, losing their basically star player and what different path could have occurred for them. But maybe we'll have to do that in the next episode. But I wanted to give a shout out to Dan Finn of Lewis, who's already dropped off to more important things, Brad Rothstadt of UC San Diego, Jay Hossick of George Mason, and Theo Edwards of CSUN. I don't know if we break for next week or do we still have the episode, because we
do
have
it. We do it.
We do it.
Yes.
We do a Q&A. Cause I did get questions this week and I didn't think we'd go this long, but yes. Excellent discussion.
Yes.
So fans, you did that. Sent me questions through DM and on Volley Talk. We're going to do it next week, cause you had great questions. So huge shout out to you guys. I know that your seasons are done, but volleyball still hasn't ended. I know you guys will be following along, and I know they love hearing what you guys got to say about what we're seeing today. So thanks again, gentlemen. I'd say good luck, but instead, get your swings right on the golf course. And Theo, hang with your superstar basketball player boy. I've been seeing those highlight reels, man.
Need some work on the golf course. That's for sure.
Thanks for listening to College Volleyball Weekly. Be sure to follow Rob Aspero at The Rob on the Mic on Instagram and at Rob on the Mic on Twitter.